Is the timing okay? Good. Yes.
Good.
Sorry for the silliness.
Yeah, oh. I think it takes.
Welcome, great people. So my title is the same. I'm continuing. It's talk two. I'm still using the same handout. I hope you have copies or a few left over there if you wish. Very briefly, just the structure of what my plan is. So first I'm going to do some yet another Alexander invariant. Then I'm going to tell you about why it is topologically significant. So it was said already, I want to say it again, and I want to say a little more. Then I'm going to go back and continue with the sort of main thread. And this means, in this case, continuing with this category of differential operators of an infinite order and how to compose them. And optimistically, I will then move and try to construct the, move on to construct the input to this infinite order differential operator machine. Right? So I will have a machine for composing operators, but I also need to tell you which operators to compose. And that will come from this solvable approximation at last. So this is optimistic. Maybe I will get there, maybe I will not. And even more optimistically, I will start telling you why all of this is actually efficient. Okay, and this is this docility business that I will come to at the end. Anyway, so, you know, I think there were 11 definitions of the Alexander polynomial so far, I'm not sure, and I just couldn't, you know, I have to put one too. And there was one on the handout already, so let me talk about, but let me also argue that this one is the best. But before that, I have to remind you a few things. So, first of all, the domain is this space of tangles, and in fact they can be virtual tangles, but you can forget about it. So basically, tangles are things like that, and what matters is that their components are numbered and oriented, or in fact they don't even have to be numbered, they just have to be labeled by some labels. One, so here's component one, component two starts at the top, does a crazy thing and goes to the bottom, and so on. And on such tangles, there are two very important operations, and then two less important operations, and then a few even less important operations that I will not mention. So the two most important operations are the disjoint union operation. The disjoint union operation and the stitching operation. So if you have a tangle T1 and a tangle T2, the disjoint union just puts them side by side. It's a binary operation, okay? And then the stitching operation is, well, MABC takes a tangle that has a strand A and a strand B and connects the head of A to the tail of B and calls the resulting long strand C. Now, it is sort of like multiplication in that, you know, if you had a word written on A and a word written on B, then the word written on C will be the concatenation of the two words. So it's sort of like multiplication, but it's definitely not multiplication because it's a unary operation. It's not even a binary operation. The input is a single tangle with two named components, but it's a unary operation. Nevertheless, it being a bit like multiplication, it satisfies a number of axioms similar to the axioms that multiplication satisfies, and the most important of which is the meta-associativity axiom, by far. This is the only real axiom. And what it says is that basically, if you want to compose three strands, so we have strand A, B, and C, then doing it first this way and then that way, or first this way and then that way, gives the same answer. Topologically, it's completely obvious, but it's a property of this algebraic structure. It's a property that this operation A, M, A, B, C has to satisfy. So if you concatenate A and B, if you stitch A to B, call the resulting strand X, and then stitch X to C, this would be, I believe, the first do this and then do that, then you have to get the same answer as whatever is written here, and you can read it yourself. The nice property, or one nice property, is that with these operations, tangles are finitely presented. I only care about finitely generated. Why are they finitely generated? Well, basically there are two generators, the overcrossing and the undercrossing, and quite clearly you can get any complicated tangle by stitching together overcrossings and undercrossings. So, you know, you want to get something complex, you just draw the crossings, take their disjoint union using the first operation, and then start stitching it to get whatever it is that you wanted to get. Okay? Good. Then the two lesser operations are the strand doubling operation. So it takes a strand named A and turns it into two daughter strands called B and C. And again, it's like a coproduct, and it satisfies axioms like a coproduct, but it's definitely not a coproduct. It doesn't go from a space to a space tensor itself. It goes from a space of tangles to the space of tangles. Okay? It's not a coproduct. And likewise, there is sort of an antipode, which is strand reversal. Okay? Good. So now, seeing that tangles are finitely generated or finitely presented even with these operations, if I want to construct an invariant of tangles, and that would include knots, because knots are just tangles with one component, well, if I want to construct such an invariant, it's enough to define it on the generators and to tell you how it changes under the two primary operations, the disjoint union and the stitching, okay? And there are several examples, and the nicest by far is the Alexander polynomial. Not by far. Sorry, I take it back. There are other really lovely examples, okay? But one nice example is, I'll call it the gold standard, is gamma calculus for the Alexander polynomial. So, okay, first of all, I have to tell you what is the target space. So, if you have a tangle T whose set of components is S, then the target space is ordered pairs, so it's in the cross product of the ring R sub S times, so second component of will be the S by S matrices whose entries are in that ring. The ring R sub S is the ring of rational functions with integer coefficients in variables T sub A, where the variables correspond to the strands of the tangle. So one variable for each strand. Okay? And one nice way of writing an element in that world of ordered pairs is to write it as a sort of matrix. This is the S by S part. But you see, these are not ordinary matrices like that are indexed by the integers or indexed by the components of the tangle. So you have to sort of make an extra row up at the top in which you name the columns, which column corresponds to which component, and likewise an extra column on the left to name the rows. But then you have nothing to do with the thing on the upper left, so you stick omega over there, and omega is the scalar part of the invariant. Okay, so basically, it's invariant is valued in augmented matrices. And now I have to tell you what are the augmented matrices for the overcrossing and the undercrossing. So if you have an overcrossing labeled AB, where A always labels the upper strand, or an undercrossing labeled AB, and again A labeled the upper strand, so sorry, I mean right-handed crossing and left-handed crossing, then the invariant will be, well, the scalar part will be 1, and the matrix part will be whatever is written here. And, you know, later you will ask me, how do you prove that this invariant agrees with the standard definition of the Alexander polynomial? One of the proofs will be to look at this matrix and say, oh, that's the Bourat representation. And in fact, you can sort of see the Alexander polynomial already here. Okay, next I have to tell you how to take the disjoint, the disjoint union. So if you have two tangles, T1 and T2, and the invariant of T1 is a pair omega 1 A1, the invariant of T2 is a pair omega 2 A2, the invariant of the disjoint union will be, well, you multiply the omegas and you take the diagonal direct sum, block diagonal sum of the two matrices. Okay? And then, so far everything is trivial, and now comes something really, really hard. And, well, it's hard, but it's formulas that fit on, nothing. So, suppose you have a tangle T that has two distinguished components, A and B, and then a further list of components, S. And you want to stitch A and B and produce C. How do you do that? And produce a component C. How do you do that? Well, okay, first of all, you write the value before the stitching, and it has a component, it has a scalar part, omega, and then a matrix, and in this matrix, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are scalar, are scalars. Theta is an entire row of further scalars, and you can tell it's a row because it has a horizontal line in the middle. Likewise for epsilon, likewise for phi and psi, which are extra columns, and then this uppercase psi is an n by n minus 2 by n minus 2 matrix, and it looks like it. Okay? And if you want to stitch A and B to produce C, the output simply looks like this. And I have nothing good to say about it except here's the formula. So omega gets replaced by 1 minus beta times omega, where beta is the entry over here. The CC entry is gamma plus alpha delta over 1 minus beta. This will be a whole row, and you can tell it's a row, right? Because it's a row plus another row multiplied by a scalar and divided by another scalar. Likewise here, this is an extra new column. And well, and this is sort of the original block part of the matrix times a column multiplied by a row. And if you multiply a column by a row, you get a matrix. So everything makes sense. Yeah.
Can every beta be 1?
No. So I should have added the condition that, or, well, when you set all the variables to 1, the matrix becomes the identity matrix. You can see it on the generators, and you can tell, and you can check that this is preserved by the operations. And therefore, if you restrict your attention to such matrices that are equal to the identity when all the variables are 1, then all the operations are well defined, and you can divide by beta because beta isn't 1. Okay? So Roland has a nice way of remembering the formula, but I never remember Roland's way of remembering from it. To the formula. Okay? Now, in a sense, we will see later, to some extent, where these formulas are coming from. At least this 1 over 1 minus beta will be clearer later. Okay? But really, it sort of doesn't matter where they come from, because let me argue that they are excellent. Okay? So, first of all, they are easy to implement. I'll tell you more about why they're excellent in a minute, but, oh, sorry, I forgot to say, there are also formulas for the strand doubling, it's a bit messy, but it's still just a formula. And for the strand reversal, and here you need an extra little bit of information, but it's information that's very, very easy to add. So really the invariant should be thought of as a triple, sort of omega, sigma, and a matrix A. Yes?
So is this the same construction of the electron polyhedron as from the Weyl algebra?
Yes. Okay. The Weyl algebra construction, when you kind of remove all the algebra or remove all the theory and stick with the matrices that remain, becomes this.
Okay.
Good.
Can you be more precise? So, I mean, what is omega and what is the matrix?
Roland just promised to do it in the next hour.
Wait, which one is the Alexander polynomial?
I didn't yet say. Sorry, you're right. So maybe I should have said that. So if you have a long knot, then the invariant ends up being a scalar omega and a 1-by-1 matrix. If it's a zero framed long knot, then the matrix part becomes one, and if not, it's uninteresting. It doesn't contain any information beyond the framing. And omega is the Alexander polynomial.
Was it one over Alexander maybe?
No, it's the Alexander. It's precisely the Alexander. If I had divided, you know, I did something artificial here. You always divide by 1 minus beta, but here at the top I multiply by 1 minus beta. I basically flipped the scalar part to make it Alexander. It's the Alexander straight. Okay? But
so it is framing dependent.
It is framing dependent, yes. Okay. Anyway, for long knots, you get the Alexander polynomial, and well, if I started reading it, I'll read the rest of the statement. It's the fastest algorithm to compute the Alexander polynomial. I'll explain why in a minute. And Nathan Dunfield implemented it in some real programming language, not Mathematica, and was able to compute the Alexander polynomial of knots with 1,000 crossings. So that's huge, okay? I wanted to also say that it's really easy to implement it. And again, this is my usual propaganda. You know, you should learn. We mathematicians should know how to implement what we do. Okay? The implementation has sort of two parts. One part is really cosmetics, and I don't want to show it to you. Everything is shown in small because I don't want to spend too much time on it. But one part is cosmetics, the other part is content. But first there is an idea, and the idea is that the way you store matrices is by storing the corresponding quadratic form. So if you have a matrix, Aij, then, or the way I wrote it over there, I don't know why I'm inventing new notation, if you have a matrix whose entries are alpha AB, then instead of storing the matrix, you introduce new variables, TA and HB, and you store the quadratic form sum of alpha AB, TA, HB. Okay? And then, if you want individual entries of the matrix, you take partial derivatives with respect to TA and TB, right, of this quadratic form, and you get this at whatever component you wanted. If you want to kill a row, you set the corresponding variable to zero. The various operations are easy to do in this language. And here is the implementation. So, first of all, if you have two ordered pairs, omega 1, lambda 1, omega 2, lambda 2, and you want to multiply them, that's the thing corresponding to this joint union, then you just multiply the omega parts and add the quadratic form. For example, one useful thing you can do is the block diagonal direct sum corresponds to simply adding the quadratic forms. And here is the main thing. If you want to stitch A and B to produce C, and your own input is gamma of omega and lambda, the ordered pair, omega and the matrix whose quadratic form is lambda, then what you do is, first you figure out what are alpha, beta, theta, gamma, delta, epsilon, phi, psi, and chi, no, psi, upper psi, by taking all sorts of partial derivatives and setting all sorts of variables to zero. Then you simply write the formulas, and that's the output. And finally, the positive crossings at A and B is given by this matrix, and the negative crossing is given by the same thing with T replaced by 1 over T. So this is a full and complete implementation. This is a program that computes the Alexander polynomial for tangles. And mind you, most people don't even know that the Alexander polynomial extends to tangles. So this is a full definition of the extension. Anyway, so let's check that it works. So first of all, let's check that it satisfies meta-associativity. I'll check it on a sufficiently large example that if it works, I know it will work. Okay, that's not a proof, but you know, the proof is just more algebra. This is a computer algebra proof. If you wanted to do it by hand, then you would call it a proof. Okay, so basically, you let the input zeta be the quadratic form, so the matrix this multiplied by this row vector and then by this column vector, so these are what the dots do. You hit enter, and then this zeta is in the memory, and then you tell the computer to compute zeta of, to take zeta and apply stitch 1 and 2 to produce 1, stitch 1 and 3 to produce 1, or do it the other way around. Again, you hit enter, you ask the computer if you're equal, if they're equal, you hit enter, the computer tells you that it's true. Now, of course, I could have faked it, but I didn't, and you'll have to believe me. Likewise, you want to check Rittmeister 3, so you label everything, you take various crossings and stitch them, you hit enter, you get the same answer for both sides, Rittmeister 3 is true. This by now is a complete proof. Well, I mean, these are the two hard axioms to check. All the others are easier. So by now I have a complete proof that this is an invariant. Okay? And now I can compute. So here is 817. You type in the crossings. So the first crossing is point number 12 goes above point number 1 in a negative crossing. This is what is written here. And then you take the product of all of these crossings. So that's like this joint union. And then you stitch 1 and k to produce 1, and you do it for all k from 2 to 16. So basically you collapse everything to a single strand, you hit enter, and the computer tells you that this is the output, and you can recognize this as the Alexander polynomial of the knot 817. Okay? And finally, one word that's not on the handout, why is this the most efficient way to compute the Alexander polynomial? Exactly because it extends to tangles and in a reasonable way. I mean, there are other extensions that are that are not reasonable. So why is extension to tangles good? So suppose you have a complicated tangle. It has n crossings. Typically, if you cut it along a line, the line will intersect it in only roughly square root of n places. Roughly, it's one dimension less. So if there are n crossings, then you can cut it with a line that will intersect it in square root of n places. And in fact, it's even better. You can find a system of lines such that each one of them intersects the tangle in roughly square root of n places, at most square root of n places. So how do you compute the invariant? You compute the invariant of everything below the white line, And then you want to go to the next line by adding a single crossing. You add the single crossing by stitching it in. Okay? But, and then you kind of repeatedly do that until you're done computing the environment. And then, at every step along the way, you see tangles with at most square root of n components. Roughly, O of square root of n components. But that means that you only see matrices whose size is square root of n by square root of n. So you compute the Alexander polynomial by managing only matrices whose size is square root of n by square root of n, which is a lot less than any other technique will give you. And that's why it's so efficient. So this is a general principle. Whenever you extend something to tangles, call it the Jones polynomial or Hovanov homology or whatever it is, you can gain efficiency because of the same trick. Yes?
How difficult or how long is it to find such a family of lines?
I don't know. So, to find an optimal family of lines is much harder than to actually compute. So I use some greedy algorithm, and I can testify that it works well, but that's not a formal proof. So when you run the when Nathan Danfield ran it on knots with 1,000 crossings, he used a variant of this greedy algorithm. You basically try to each step you find a crossing that doesn't that keeps the front as short as possible. The front being the intersection of the knot with the line. So in practice it works. Okay? So you're right. You have a good point there. Yes?
Do you know what the complexity should be of this algorithm?
I keep forgetting. I think it's n to the 3/2.
And the number of crossings.
The number of crossings to the 3/2, but that uses naive matrix multiplication. So you know, if you have n by n matrices to multiply them, naively it takes n cubed operations. But then there are very very clever algorithms that shorten this. So I think it's n to the 3/2. With naive, so if you really wanted to be optimal, you could make it even faster. But should I think about it from? No, I don't want to think about it in real life. But okay. Other questions? Okay.
To get back to the lines, do you use like probability, set a random family of lines and check that they do not intersect crossings, or
No. You use a greedy algorithm.
Okay.
The greedy algorithm is, well, you find, suppose you find this line and you want to find the next.
Okay.
A line really means adding an extra crossing. You add the crossing that increases the front the least. So basically, if the front of the computation, so basically, here is what you've already computed, okay? Now, I don't know, here is what you've already computed. And you could add either this crossing or that crossing or that crossing or I guess there are other few variants. But the adding this one would be stupid, because you will be, so turning the new front to be this would be stupid, because you've just, sorry, I mean, you still have to, I mean, this would be the new front, because you've just extended it by four lines, by four crossing points. Adding this one extends the front by two, makes the front two longer. Adding this crossing shrinks the size of the front. So basically you choose which crossing to add by which one makes the front the smallest. I could actually show you the code that does it. It's again just one line of code. It seems complicated, but it isn't. Okay, here's the remote. Okay, so now I wanted to say a few words about how this is valuable to topology. And I think genus was discussed enough, so I don't want to say anything more about it, except the moment you have tangles and strand doubling, you have genus, and this is just, well, no, you can't see anything with the current lighting, so let's just move on. Instead, I want to say something about ribbon knots. Should I, or is it a waste of time, or... Should I say? I don't know. Okay. So what's a ribbon knot? So a ribbon knot is a knot that can be presented as the boundary of a disk that is allowed to have singularities. Obviously, every knot can be presented as the boundary of a disk, namely, with singularities. Namely, take the knot, contract it to nothing, and the movie of the contraction is a disk which self-intersects. If it didn't self-intersect, it would be the R-knot. Okay? However, in a ribbon knot, I'm only allowing ribbon singularities and disallowing class singularities. I could give a formal definition, but it's much better to just stare at it for a moment and understand. So basically, here, the parts of the knot are in red, and the parts of the disk are in the disk is this blue membrane here. And in a ribbon singularity, you see intersection. You're allowing intersections like this, and the intersections I'm not allowing are class singularities, which look like that locally. Okay, and then some knots allow such ribbon disks, and some do not. For example, this knot drawn here is clearly a ribbon knot, but the trefoil isn't. Okay. So that's one important definition. And there is a famous conjecture about ribbon knots, and that they are the same as slice knots. So what's a slice knot? So a slice knot is a knot in S3, which you view S3 as being the boundary of the four-dimensional ball, and a slice knot is a knot which can be presented as the boundary of a non-singular disk in that ball. So it's probably better to view it one dimension below. So basically, think of R3 as being this plane, and then this plane is the boundary of the half space below it, which is the four-dimensional ball. Then a slice knot is a knot that can be drawn on R3, so here, and then be presented as the boundary of some non-singular disk in the four-dimensional space. Well, so a slice knot is one for which you can find a non-singular disk in four-dimensional space whose boundary is the knot that's drawn here. Okay? So I claim that the knot shown here, and in fact, every ribbon knot is also slice. Why? So basically, take these membranes and sort of let them sag, fall down into four-dimensional space. Okay? Into the fourth coordinate. So if you wish, sort of when you go from one side to the other, when you go into the depth of the disk, you also let it fall down into the fourth dimension and then rise back again when you approach the boundary once again. Okay? And then reconstruct this ribbon in such a way that this part, the part that goes this way, is a bit thinner, so that its membrane sags down, falls down less. And then this green intersection line simply disappears because this membrane had fallen further down into Earth, into the fourth dimension. Okay? You cannot do it here. Okay? So anyway, this proves that every ribbon knot is slats. And there is a famous conjecture, it's called the ribbon slice conjecture, and one formulation of it is that ribbon is equal to slice. Though I prefer the negation, the formulation which says that some slice knots are actually not ribbon. It is not known. Okay? So you need a criteria to show that a knot is not ribbon. You need somehow, given a knot, how do you show that it's sliced? That's easy, you present a disk in four dimensions, okay? And how do you show that it's not ribbon? That's hard, because you need to somehow show that no ribbon disk exists. That's a priori harder. So you need a criteria to show that that a knot is not ribbon, or a method of showing that a knot is not ribbon. And one such way is the Fox-Milner theorem. So the Fox-Milner theorem says that the Alexander polynomial of a ribbon knot is always of a specific form. So it's always of the form, it's a polynomial A of t such that you can find another polynomial F of t such that F of t times F of 1 over t is the Alexander polynomial. So if you compute the Alexander polynomial of the trefoil knot, you find that you cannot find such a rough square root f of it, and therefore the Alexander polynomial, the trefoil knot is not ribbon. Okay? Unfortunately, the Fox-Milner condition cannot help you for the conjecture here, because the same statement is also true for slice knots. Okay? Okay. But I claim that the moment you understand tangles, you can you have a new way, potentially, of getting non-slice of getting conditions for being non-ribbon. And you know, I'm not sure if I'm being wise. Basically, there is a definition, just like Roland was showing us a definition of genus using tangles, there is also a definition of ribbon using tangles. Namely, so suppose you have a tangle T with 2n components, here 2n is 4, then there are two operations that you can do. You can do the operation tau, which is stitch at the top, and the operation kappa, which is stitch at the bottom, and also at the top with a shift. Okay? And then kappa produces a knot, that's why it's called kappa, and tau produces again a tangle, and that's why it's called tau. And you can show that a knot is ribbon if and only if there exists a tangle with 2n components whose tau is the untangle, is the trivial tangle, and whose kappa is your knot. And if you think about it a little bit, you find that this leads to an algebraic condition on, so now suppose you had an invariant z that respects all of the operations, so for example, any invariant that respects stitching would do, and then you can form a certain set, basically the inverse image of 1 via tau and apply kappa to it, and then if the invariant of a specific knot does not fall within this set, then the knot cannot be ribbon. Okay? Maybe I should have also said that sort of the smallest potential example for slice equals ribbon, so this is a slice knot, and it's not known if it's ribbon or not. So it's pretty large, it has 48 crossings. So, you know, another condition for all of this system to be useful is that you would be able to compute it on pretty large knots. Okay, so hence I care about polynomiality. And there is actually a stronger reason, but I think I want to skip it right now in the interest of time. And, you know, if you want an example, here is a tangle T whose tau closure, so if you close it at the top, clearly everything slurps in and it becomes the untangle. And on the other hand, if you close it with the kappa closure, you get the ribbon knot that was displayed before. And then the final thing to say about it is that my student Huan Vo is now writing a thesis in which Fox-Milner is proven for ribbon knots using this technology. So, okay. Now you could say that was proven long ago, but somehow the point is that the technology does not generalize to slice. So if you use the same technology for other invariants, you potentially get things that will distinguish ribbon for slice, from slice. And that's my real interest. Sorry if I'm... any questions, comments? I think I'm being... I was a bit loose here. Yeah.
So maybe a controversial question. In the community, how many people think that the conjecture will be true?
People think the conjecture is false.
Okay.
The conjecture as written is true.
Okay.
Namely, slice is not equal to ribbon.
Okay, so it's not controversial.
So people think that slice is not equal to ribbon. And people think that it will be very hard to produce a counterexample, precisely because we don't have good ways of proving that something is not ribbon.
Thank you. And do you know of the philosophical reason why we think it's not true? Why we think that slice is different?
It's not what I'm expert in. So the answer is no. But I think the real answer is people tried really hard to prove that slice is equal to ribbon and found no reason why it would be true.
Okay.
Plus there are suggested counterexamples like this one. And nobody can show that it's a ribbon, but we just don't know how to prove that it isn't a ribbon. Yeah.
The Alexander of this one has been calculated, I guess.
Of course, yeah.
And
this is a slice knot. So the Alexander must satisfy Fox-Milner.
So how would your technology do something with this example that other...
The technology says, suppose you had an invariant Z which respects these operations, then you can do things. You must have an invariant which respects these operations. The only example we've shown so far is the Alexander polynomial. Now I need to work hard to produce the next example.
And these operations are just cut closure and...
Two types of closures, yes.
And how would it... Maybe you said this, but I was kind of...
I've skipped many things. I've skipped the proof of the statement that the knot is ribbon if and only if it has some property with kappa and tau.
And what is the statement?
A knot is ribbon if you... So something over here is ribbon. If you can find something over here that projects to it and whose projection to the left is the untangled, the trivial tangle. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I want to switch gears and go back to constructing invariants. So, wait, what was this for? Oh no, this I did. So, let me remind you what, so again, if you fell asleep, this is an excellent time to wake up because I'm switching gears, okay? So let me remind you, sort of, there is the quantum group technology, quantum universal and galloping algebra technology to construct invariants. Basically, you find an R matrix, and then you need to multiply, co-multiply, do all sorts of silly things with this R matrix. Basically, you need to understand the line at the top. If you choose a basis of the Lie algebra, you can always replace the universal enveloping algebra, or even the quantized universal enveloping algebra, by various symmetric algebras. And in these symmetric algebras, so really you need to understand elements of a symmetric algebra completed, and then various operations. Now, an operation, a homomorphism from one symmetric algebra to another, is simply an element of the symmetric algebra generated by the dual basis to the domain and the basis of the target. Okay? And I have a convention of notation. So the dual of x is xi, the dual of y of eta, of y is eta, and so on. And this is all lovely, and the only problem is that I really work in completions. So the elements that I see over here are not polynomials, but power series. And power series are much harder to work with. Okay. And I also should remind you what is the composition law. So if you have a function f, a morphism f, from the symmetric algebra on B0 to the symmetric algebra on B1, and a morphism B, G, from the symmetric algebra on B1 to the symmetric algebra on B2. Now this means that the sort of tensor corresponding to F is a power series or polynomial in the variables zeta0 I. So zeta0 is the sort of input variables, or the dual variables corresponding to the generators of B0. And with outputs in Z1 and indexed by some other index J. And likewise, the tensor corresponding to G is a power series in variables zeta1j, which correspond to the dual variable of the thing in the middle, and zeta2k, which correspond to the variables on the right. And then the composition law is, so if you want to compose G with F, the tensor corresponding to it, and I think we essentially did it last time, but it's basically some differential operator composition. So you take G, you replace all the zetas in it by differentiations with respect to their duals, apply this differential operator to F, and compute all of this in Z1, in all the Z1s set to zero. And here I've assumed that these are completely distinct variables. If you use the same name twice, here and here, you need to invent locally just for the duration of the computation a new name so that you don't get confused. Okay? And then I've shown a few examples. And the point is that they were all Gaussian. So the identity map is an exponential like this. So that's a Gaussian. Variable renamed map is another Gaussian. The archetypal multiplication map, so basically the commutative multiplication, is another Gaussian. The co-multiplication is yet another Gaussian. R matrices tend to give Gaussians too. And I've given a few more examples, and for now I want to skip them and switch to a general theorem. The general theorem is how to compute. So again, what do I want to do? So I have two Gaussian differential operators. So infinite order differential operators of the form e to the sum z coefficients aij zi d to d z, maybe I should call it z zero I, and then d to d zero one j, and I want to know how to compose two such things. If it was a finite thing, it would be easy. But this exponentiation means that it's not finite. Okay? So, it turns out that it's convenient to rather than binding two things, my name for composition is binding. It will be clearer later. So rather than binding two things, it's nicer to zip them. So let me explain. So suppose you have these two things and you want to compose them. So basically, I don't know, the teeth at the bottom are differential, are derivations, and the teeth at the top are variables to be differentiated, and you want to pair them. Okay? Well, doing it all at once is hard. So you might want to do it first for half of the variables, so you sort of zip half of the variables, but half of the variables remain unzipped. So you still have to apply these derivatives to these variables, so as to get the completed bound thing. Okay? But after you've zipped half the variables, the two things are no longer separate. So what remains, the zipping that remains, is not the same kind of composition as before. So I need to define what zipping means, and zipping means doing half of a binding. Okay? So now suppose I have a polynomial in simply a single set of variables and dual variables, and this single set is really the union of the two sets that I had before. Okay? And I'll define the zipping of this polynomial along the variables zeta j's and their duals, the z's, to be, well, you simply substitute into all the z's, into all the zetas, you substitute derivations with respect to z, and you apply them to the z's.
And so
it's a commutative polynomial, but for the purpose of this, I'm putting all the zetas first, so that differentiations can act on the z's which appear later. And then I set all the z's to be zero. I think the best is to... to show an example. So if the polynomial p is some linear combinations of zeta to the n, z to the m, what I do is so the polynomial written here becomes sum anm differentiation with respect to z to the power n applied to z to the m, all of this evaluated at z equals to zero. And you can check that, well, this is equal to 0 unless n is equal to m, and if n is equal to m, then you get n factorial. So therefore, the zipping of this polynomial with respect to the variable zeta gives that answer. Okay? Are you with me? You know, really, sort of, I like to think of polynomials as, sort of, here is a polynomial. a polynomial has some z's and some zetas, and the zip operation just means you sum over all ways of connecting a z to a zeta. Okay, pairing a z with a zeta. Okay. So now the main theorem. Okay. So, and this is really the most important theorem of the whole subject. So please listen. Okay. So maybe I'll go straight to here. So I want to tell you how to do zippings of Gaussians, but thinking about the future, I do perturbed Gaussians. So now P is a perturbation to a Gaussian. So P is a polynomial in zetas and z's, and in fact the only conditions that I want to put on it is that it will have a finite degree with respect to the zetas. The zetas will become differentiations, so I want P to have at most finitely many differentiations in it. This is the perturbation, that's not the main part. Then I need to tell you about the Gaussians, the Gaussian part. So for the Gaussian part, I need variables y's and variables q's that will appear in the formula here, in the formulas that appears here. And what I want from them is that they will be small. What does it mean small? If we were in analysis, I would say smaller than epsilon. We're not in analysis. So what I really mean is that there is some grading in the business, and they are of high degree, or degree one, degree higher than zero. So if you take high powers of them, you get things of very high degree, and therefore, if you mod out by high degrees, then it's convergent. Okay? Sorry, maybe I said something confusing. The way analysts say that e to the x is convergent, so people in analysis say that e to the x is convergent by saying that x, or in general a power series, e to the x by chance is always convergent. But I mean, in general, a power series is convergent if x is very, very small. The way people in algebra say that e to the x is convergent is by saying that the degree of x is equal to is greater than zero. And so if you look at sum x to the n over n factorial, and you only care to look at it up to degree 700, then the terms beyond n equal to 700 will not contribute. So up to any fixed degree, it's a finite sum. So when I say small, I really mean small in this algebraic sense. Okay? And now I can state the theorem. Suppose you have a perturbed Gaussian. So you have the exponential of some constant C plus some linear combinations of the z's with coefficients eta, on which I didn't assume anything, plus some linear combination of the y, of the zetas with coefficients y, which I'm assuming are small, plus a quadratic. Sorry, I should have assumed that the etas are also small, otherwise this doesn't even make sense. And I should have assumed that C is also small. I don't know why I didn't assume anything. Sorry. Anyway, so I have here, here is the quadratic form. So some quadratic form Qij multiplying Zi with Psi j. I exponentiate all of this, multiply it by a perturbation polynomial, or not quite polynomial, a perturbation function. But the condition on this function is that its degree in the zetas is finite. Again, here this is in an infinite degree in the zetas because it has an exponentiation. So sort of this is messy, this is not. And then I zip it to itself along the zeta variables. The claim is that what I get is written over here. The answer is written over here. Let me draw it, and the drawing will also suggest that this is a true statement. Okay? So what does this look like in a picture? So in a picture, I have, here is the thing that I'm about to zip. It has a P part, and I don't know, let's declare that the zetas are at the top and the z's are at the bottom, so maybe there are lots of things going to the bottom, but only finitely many things going up to towards the top. Okay? Then it has Then it has the eta I, z I parts. These are really things that point to the bottom, so they have z i's at the bottom, and each z I comes with a coefficient. I mean, these z's are created out of nothing, but they have coefficients, so each one comes with an eta coefficient, with its own eta coefficient. Okay? Likewise, I have the y I zeta j parts, so I have parts with zetas at the top, these are the zeta j's, and they all come with coefficients which are y's. And finally, there is the hardest part. The hardest part is this, and this is really a part where you have zetas at the top, z's at the bottom, and they come with coefficients qij, which I'll write like that. Okay? Now, this is a single thing. This is a reservoir of things. What's a reservoir? It means you take any number of such things, like it's really a sum of any numbers of copies of this line, of this kind of blob, but if you take n of them, you divide by n factorial. Okay? And this is likewise a reservoir, and this is likewise a reservoir. There can be many, many, many more such lines. Okay? I started telling you stories about exponentials. I have to tell you some more. Let me say, e to the x is the true Hilbert hotel. So you all know the Hilbert hotel, right? The Hilbert hotel is this famous hotel that has infinitely many rooms, and if you want to make room for another guest, you sort of move all the guests to the right and you have more room. Sort of adding or removing a room from the Hilbert Hotel keeps it the Hilbert Hotel. In fact, splitting the Hilbert Hotel into two, the odd Hilbert Hotel and the even Hilbert Hotel, gives you two Hilbert Hotels. So that's nonsense. It talks about infinity. I don't know infinity. I don't know how to implement infinity. But e to the x really is the Hilbert Hotel. So what's e to the x? E to the x is basically a reservoir of x's, in the same sense as here. So if you have n of them, you divide by n factorial. And it has properties. So one property is that if you delete one x, you sum of all ways of deleting one x, you still get the exact same reservoir. That's the property that e to the x prime is equal to e to the x, right? If you delete one, prime just means delete one x. kill one x from a polynomial, and you still get the same thing. And likewise, if you have a reservoir, and you apply to it the operation where each element, each thing in it decides whether it wants to be whether it wants to go to the left hotel or to the right hotel. So, in other words, you replace x by x left plus x right. So now you have two hotels, which are decided by each x decided whether it wanted to go to the left. So here are all the left copies and here are all the right copies. But each of them is in itself a complete reservoir, just like before. And that's just the statement that e to the xl plus xr is equal to e to the xl, e to the xr. Sorry, that was an aside. I just felt I had to say it. Okay, I mean, I hope you forgive me for wasting your time with the theory of reservoirs. But I'll use it here. I use it in saying things like, I start doing operations. The operations never exhaust the reservoirs. Whatever I do, they remain the same. Okay. So I described the element. I described this thing. Right here, p times the exponential, so p times, these are the three parts of the exponential. And now I want to glue top to bottom. So what do I get when I glue top to bottom? I could just glue a thing from here to here. Lovely. But I could do more interesting things. I could start from something here, glue it to here. Now it comes out here multiplied by Q. Q is really a matrix, but you can ignore it. Or it comes into... Anyway. It comes out here. Then you can glue it again. Then you can do it again. And by the way, you do it again and again, and the reservoir remains the same. It doesn't care. That's the theory of reservoirs. Okay? But you see, the Qs are small. So this is sort of a finite, or up to a certain degree, it's a finite process. So eventually, you have to connect either to here, or, when you come out, you connect back to here somewhere. Okay?
So, but you glue only once in every place? When in your picture, you glue twice.
Oh, because my picture is messy, but
no,
I wanted it once. On the left?
Yes. Right.
Yeah, no. It's only once. Anything can be glued only once, but this exists as a single thing. This is a sort of a fish in the reservoir, and these are reservoirs. These here you can really go repeatedly. Okay. So what do we get? So for example, like take the fish, okay? If it wasn't for the exponential terms, I would simply glue top to bottom in all possible ways and go home. But now I glue top to bottom, but instead of gluing top to bottom, I could have gone through the reservoir any number of times and only then glue to the bottom. Okay? So basically, instead of simply gluing top to bottom, as before, I could think of it as gluing top to bottom, but with weight either one, which means going once, just going directly, or 1 plus q, which would mean going through the reservoir once, or 1 plus q squared, which would mean going through the reservoir twice, or I think you all know the arithmetic series. So really, it's gluing with weight 1 over 1 minus q. Okay? And the same happens for every other scenario that you can have here. So I told you of one scenario. One scenario is you start at the top here and at the bottom, but go through the reservoir a certain the Q reservoir a certain number of times. But alternatively, I could start with one of these, and then it would glue maybe to one of these here. This is naively, but now that I have the reservoir of Qs, I could do it with a going through this reservoir any number of times with so I'll get an arithmetic progression. Okay? And likewise, I could go from the y's to the etas either directly or going through the reservoir. And finally, there are annoying terms where you just stay in the reservoir. So you glue this to the bottom, and then you go again, and then you go again, and you cycle a certain number of times, and then you go back to where you started. So you get a complete loop of Q things. Okay? So you can sort of be very diligent and write what each of these terms becomes. And then you put all the terms together, and you get the overall answer, and this is the overall answer. So, maybe I'll just read it to you. But sort of the main point in it is, first of all, I have to, now Q becomes a matrix, so I have to take the matrix 1 minus Q, the identity minus Q, and invert it and call the resulting matrix Q tilde. And then you have here various terms. For example, the term written over here. Let's look at the term eta I Q tilde I YK. What is this term? I'm assuming summation here. Okay? So the term, basically the last term, 1, 2, and 3. What is this term? This is really the term where you start with an eta, go through the machine some number of times, and come back to a y. Right? So you start with an eta, end with a y, and go through the and the q tilde is the a matrix an entry of 1 over 1 minus q, so this represents going through the machine a number of times. Okay? Likewise, every other term corresponds to one of the scenarios that can happen here. The determinant of q tilde corresponds to just the self loops in the q side, on the q side.
So draw. What is better on the right hand side than on the left?
What is better?
No. What is better?
Better. Oh. So maybe I should now read the right hand side in full. I sort of told you how I got to it.
If you still have a zeta j at the very end.
Yeah. So no. I told you how I got to it, but now let me tell you what it is and why is it good. Okay. So what it is the following. The determinant of Q tilde, well, this is a matrix. You can compute its determinant. I know how to do it. It's a finite process. Take the original polynomial and replace the z variables by some Q tilde acting on the Z's plus the Y's, again, this is a finite process. The zeta variables are unchanged, and that's a good news because the polynomial was of a finite degree in the zeta, so this is still a finite degree polynomial in the zeta. The really good news is whatever happens here. Before, over here, we had zetas. Sorry, before gluing, before doing this process, we had zetas in the exponential, and the zetas become differentiations. But now, there are no longer any zetas in the exponent. So this is simply a function of the z's and the other inputs, the etas and the whatever. So now, if I glue zetas, so if I glue zetas to z's, I have at most finitely many zetas to worry about. This is the only place where zeta appears, and it, and it appears in a finite degree. Okay? So this really is applying a differential, a finite order differential operator to, well, a messy exponential, but you know, students of calculus even know how to differentiate exponentials. So this is really, so I've reduced an infinite computation to a finite differentiation exercise. Gregor, did I answer?
Yes.
Did you get the answer? Maybe.
Maybe.
Okay, yes.
I'm sorry, it's a stupid question. I'm confused about the status of the y's with respect to the z's. So there are variables, and there are which are the z's and the y's. But there are as many y's as z's, because you have some...
No, the status is z's and zetas are active variables. These are the variables that I'm going to glue. Right? But I want to glue them all. I want to tell you how to glue the most general thing. So I want to put, I want to write a general quadratic. I need to tell you, I need to have coefficients. The coefficients are qijs, the y's, and the etas.
Yeah.
So the y's and the etas are coefficients. So really, this isn't just a quadratic. This is an off-centered quadratic. It's a quadratic plus linear terms. So this is sort of the linear functional. The y's represent the linear functional that's applied to the zetas, and the etas represent the linear functional that's applied to the z's. Okay? Did I answer?
I still have a doubt. I mean, is it a... Should I think of it as a coefficient, so as such as a number, or
as function,
as a variable?
Sorry, as numbers, as numbers.
Because
the y's are simple numbers.
But then, when you put it in, on the right, when you put it inside with the zk plus yk, is it
well,
still
take zk and add to it yk
as a number.
If zk is a variable, you can add, you can look at z plus 3.
Okay, that's the way I should think of it.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So they don't interact with the etas.
What do you mean? They're numbers. The z, the y's are numbers, the etas are numbers.
Mm, you don't glue them.
Oh no, there is no gluing inside here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, sorry, I put it one on top of the other just to save space. I mean, really, you know, if I wanted to put, you know, really, I might not, I should have been more consistent. Here I put q's in the middle and I really meant coefficients. I really meant coefficients. Here, there is a coefficient eta next to each such little thing. And here there is a coefficient y next to each z. The variables are on the outside, and these are just coefficients. Okay.
Sorry, maybe my doubt is important. Zeta j, the variable that, on which you're zipping, is just a single one, or it's, it can be a set of zeta j, it can be all of them.
In the drawing, I didn't make distinction between the variables. But really, you should be thinking of them as being, there are many variables. Many, otherwise I wouldn't need matrices, it would be all in, so the same is true on with, if you have only one variable, but then all the matrices become scalars. But,
In this notation, are you meaning that you're contracting only
zeta j, the symbol for a fixed j, or the set of all zeta j?
Oh, this is a set. This is what the parameterization is.
It's a set
means.
Of all zeta j.
So I contract all the z's with all the zetas.
So then I explain why I'm confused, because I'm expecting that you can do partial zipping, so you will be left with some variables. And if you consider lines as constants, then
yeah,
there will
but
be no more variables.
This includes the partial case. Namely, I could just declare that some of the zetas and some of the z's are really y's and etas, or coefficients.
But then there are no variables.
I said some of them.
Yeah, okay, but those became coefficients.
Yeah.
After this computation, there are no longer variables. That's what I'm not...
No,
maybe it's better to say that they're in separate tensor factor. So they act as scalars, but they're not scalars. They're just in a different tensor factor.
So after the result, they reacquire the status of variables. So that you can use them to zip.
Okay.
We're just pairing
you
in
know,
the tensor product. So there is no variable.
You know, you have the same... You have the same issue. Sorry, I'm going to make fun of you.
Please.
Francesco. Francois, I don't know which one. Sorry. You have the same issue that high school students have with variables, right? When you say solve the equation 2x plus 2 is equal to 3, I mean, is x a number or a variable? Or when you do, it's a number for the purpose of a computation, or you want to imagine it as a number, or it's a formal variable. Well, there's no difference. So, okay, if you are computing,
my problem is that it is indexed as z, so it looks like it is a companion of z. So there are twice the number of variables.
Oh. Right, but, if you have a quadratic in 17 variables, let's declare that 17 is 2, okay? So a quadratic in 2 variables will look like ax squared plus bxy plus c y squared. Okay? Now, suppose I declare that I want to think of it as a as a function only of y. Okay? So it's still a quadratic. If you restrict a quadratic to any plane or any subspace, it's still a quadratic. It's a quadratic in which the quadratic here the quadratic form, maybe let's do it 2. Okay, here the matrix of this quadratic is the matrix A, B, B, C. Okay, after you declare that only Y is the variable you care about, it becomes the quadratic whose matrix is C, whose linear part is 2BX, and whose constant part is ax squared. So in fact, that's why here I wanted quadratics with linear pieces and constant pieces. So basically, if you take this quadratic and think of it as a function of just some of the variables, it's still a quadratic, just that just with new y's and with new etas and with new c's. Yes.
So that means that the zipping allows us to zip on a subset of the variables and then zip again on the...
Yeah. You could do that. In fact, I will do that in a minute. I'm terribly sorry. You know, if this is very confusing, well, actually, it's not inherently difficult. I'm making it difficult. I apologize.
So just clarifications that y's could actually be z's. Z you say these are constants?
So, if I decide that the active variables are only z5 and on,
yeah.
then all the other z's get thrown into the y's and the c's.
Okay, so the y's could depend on some of the z's you settled fixed.
The y are abstract symbols.
Okay.
You can plug into them anything you want. Okay? They're variables. You can plug into them anything. Sorry, I should. Well, this is also the first time I'm presenting it, so maybe next time I'll do better.
I think.
Yeah.
Very maybe suggestion. I think it's helpful to do something I just did, namely, suppose P is 1.
Yeah.
And C is 0, eta is 0, y is 0. And Q is 1.
Then you're left with the determinant.
And you just have E to the Z zeta on the left-hand side. And then you look at the right, and then you will see that when you zip you get infinities.
No.
Yes, because you get sum.
But Q is small. Remember that Q has...
No, I put Q equal to 1. I just try to do the easiest
but
case.
But 1 doesn't... 1 is not a small number.
Yeah, exactly. And so you see that so that means one actually needs the Q. And then on the right hand side you see you just get nothing. If all these things are zero, then you just have E to the zero. But when you compute the left hand side, you get the sum of the Q to the n's. And so you get 1 over 1 minus Q, which is just the term of E to the left.
Yeah.
And all the rest, I think, is just air.
No. No,
I mean,
it's not.
I mean, it's not just air. But I mean, it's somehow generalized from this. That's what I would guess. No.
No. I told you that the way to view it is just what I said, what I did. One way to view it. By the way, let me. I actually didn't want to prove this. I was going to do something else. I don't know why I got into the proofs. I mean, proofs are docile. Computations are sacred. Sorry. So let me. But if I did it, let me tell you that there is another proof. So I gave sort of the intuition. I gave how I got there. Yeah.
Can one prove it by, passing to Gaussian integrals? In the standard?
Yes. That's
maybe. In fact, yes, you can. But then this would go against my religion. And I can't do it. Because what integration? Are you kidding me? This is algebra. But yes, you could do it with Gaussian integrals. So basically the operation of contraction, or at least the composition of two operators, is something like so you write you want to turn some variables into differentiation. So you take the Fourier transform of 1, multiply it with the other, you take the Fourier transform back, and you have to see how this acts on quadratics. And so you could, I'm sure you could do it this way. It would go against my religion. I wouldn't do it.
So actually, my question was, I mean, I'm sure you can do the single zipping by Gaussian integral. But the equality, is it a Fubini-like statement or in the
It's Gaussian? A statement about convolutions of Gaussians. Can be turned into a statement about convolution of Gaussians. Or perturbed Gaussians. Okay? Alternatively, if you want an algebraic proof, you can just replace Q by H bar times Q, and then at H bar equals to 0, it becomes a relatively easy statement, and then you have to differentiate with respect to H bar, and you show that the two sides are equal, and that becomes sort of a finite exercise, and therefore, the two sides solve the same differential equation, and therefore they're the same. Okay, you could do it. But the way to guess this formula is to do this. This is what I have in my mind. Okay? Okay. I'm sorry, I'm terribly sorry. But I'll go on for another few minutes, if it's okay. I want to say that you can implement all of this, and this is the real proof. Okay, it actually works. Okay? So, I'm defining the Kronecker delta. It's needed for the inverse matrix. So, Kronecker delta of ij is, if they're equal, it's 1, otherwise it's 0. I'm defining the dunes, so if you put a star on a z, you get a zeta. I'm defining it only for a subset of the alphabet, because that's all I need. Ui dual is the u dual I. That's, again, just the... Okay? And then, here is the definition of zip for polynomials. So what does it mean to zip a polynomial with respect to variables? Basically, you look for patterns within that polynomial p, which are of the form a function times zeta to the d, and then you replace it by differentiations d times with respect to z star, setting z star to 0. So this is really the definition of zip. And here are examples. So stuff in with shaded background is programmed, and stuff with white background is executions. So let's zip with respect to the variable zeta this polynomial. So what do you expect to get? Well, you know what you get. But why do you get that? So this zeta pairs with this z and you get a 7. This zeta to the 6 pairs with zeta to the 5 e to the z, and you get the linear term of e to the z, which is just z, so you get a times 720, 6 factorial, so this is this. And finally, the 99b is just a random variable, okay? This has no zetas and no z's, so the zipping is to glue all the zetas to all the z's. There's only one way to do it. This is 0 factorial, so you just get left with the 99b. Here is a zip with respect to two variables, zeta and eta, of zeta cubed, eta cubed, e to the ax, b to the... So basically, I glue the zetas to the x's and the etas to the y's, but first I have to expand the exponential. I claim that this is the answer, and this is because the computer computed it, but you can play again and try to see where did each term came from. So for example, where did the 6c cubed come from? It came from pairing the zeta cubed, eta cubed, to the cxy raised to the third power, which you would get from the exponentiation.
So yeah. Put zip in the zeta and then zip to the eta.
Oh, so I could do it in two steps, yes. I could. Maybe... Yeah, okay. I mean, if I had more time, I would just start up the program and show you that it works, but... okay. Anyway, here is the actual implementation of the... of the main theorem. So EQP is a short notation for e to the power q multiplied by p. So q should be a quadratic and p should be a polynomial. Sorry, not necessarily a polynomial. It has to be of finite degrees in the zetas. It could have arbitrary functions of z, like e to the z, sine of z, but it must be finite degree in the zetas. So I basically will not show you the details, but only highlight. So you have to figure out what the y's are. So the y's are certain pieces of this quadratic q, which are obtained by setting some of the variables to zeta. So you take q, you differentiate with respect to the zetas, and you map certain things to zero. Likewise, maybe the most interesting line is this line. So qt stands for q tilde. So q tilde is, you form a table of partial derivatives of q, partial derivatives, double partial derivatives of q precisely finds the matrix underlying the quadratic. So this So this gives you the matrix of the quadratic. You take the Kronecker delta minus this. This is 1 minus the matrix. You tell Mathematica to invert this matrix. This is the inverse. And this is Q tilde. And then finally, you output the determinant of Q tilde multiplied by various things. But this is a back reference to the zip of before, to the zip of ordinary polynomials. And now I can test it. So I let E to be a general quadratic. So basically, I've put here the most general quadratic you can have in three variables, x, I, and zeta, j. And here I put an arbitrary function for the p part, but only of degree 1 in the zeta. So this is an incomplete test, because I only did it to degree 1 in the zetas. Sorry, psi. I don't know why I switched. And then you ask the computer to print the zipping of E1, so the zipping of this thing, with respect to psi 1 and zeta 2, sorry, psi 2 and psi 1 and psi 2, but print it in short form, print only 5 lines. And because it's a huge expression, I don't want it to fill the handout. So, you get various messy things, but you can recognize these things as various parts of the inverting the matrix Aij. So, like you have here, divided by various minors of Aij, of 1 minus Aij. So you can sort of recognize that it has the right feel, but then many terms are skipped, so 17 terms are not shown. Okay? And then this is the one question that was asked. I take the left-hand side and I compare it with taking E1 and first zipping Z2, sorry, Z2, and then zipping Z2, so doing it in two stages, and the answer is true. You get the same answer. You get the right answer. So zipping does have this stage-by-stage property. Next, so again, I don't want to go through the details, but now I look at EH. EH is that same E as before, sorry, the same E as before, but with the quadratic multiplied by H. Really, here there is an H multiplying the quadratic. So H is my small parameter, okay? And I expand EH, so I take EH and replace E of QP. E of QP stands for E to the Q times P. So I write E to the Q times P and compute it as a power series in H to H cubed. So the output is now an ordinary polynomial with no exponentials anymore, because I computed it to a power, because I essentially expanded the exponentials. So now I apply to it the usual zip, the trivial zip function, and I get a certain answer. I then compare it with first zipping and then expanding, and I get that the two things are equal. So that's the real proof of the formula. Okay, this is the proof of the formula. It works. Okay. What is this? Oh, this is the bind which is made by doing several zips. But I think I skip it, and because I'm out of time. And just summarize. So, and I'm terribly sorry. I mean, I think well, I don't know what to say. You have to stare at this formula and digest it. Okay? This is the formula that allows you to compose anything with anything else. So at some later point, I will have to tell you why the things we need to compose are always of that form. I'll stop. You know, this really has, this is really cultural, you know, this is sort of, this should have been in high school algebra. It's sort of not a part of the complexity of the subject. It's a sort of an exercise on the side somehow. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes.
Something back to the beginning. So you said the trefoil is not sliced by using Fox Milner.
Yeah.
Is there a way to see it directly? Why it can't be sliced?
You mean can't be reborn?
No, it can't be sliced. Trefoil is not sliced anyway.
There ought to be, but I don't.
So is it clear that the disc you get by just coning is not a plug?
There are other invariants that would do it.
Why?
If you believe that the threshold is not the unknot, then it is clear that the cone of the threshold is not topologically flat. Because if it were, if they could create a small ball around the singular, the center of the ball, of the four ball, and if it were topologically flat by definition, then the intersection of this cone with the boundary of the small ball would be the trivial knot, by definition of topologically flat. And that's not. That would give you an isotopy between the trefoil and the unknot. Because
but that should work for any
that's give you a topologically flat disk in
default. Ah, my question was the wrong question.
I think you can also see that it's not sliced because it has significant noise.
Right, but you need an invariant. You can't just eyeball.
Yeah, you need to know that the knot is not trivial.
To prove that the trefoil is not sliced, you can just compute the signature, I think, not use Fox Milner. I think it's
I didn't prove that the trefoil is not sliced. I just proved the cone you took wasn't topologically flat.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry, Dora, I have a very elementary question for you, but not for me. So. I have a concrete example, which I am not able to compute, and which is looks simple. So, can you think it's feasible?
Sure. Let's tell me.
So, there is no polynomial part. It's just in the exponent.
Yeah.
It's just for that. And it's z4.
Sorry.
It's z4 exponential of z4 times zeta 2 plus zeta 3. Plus
zeta plus outside the parentheses?
Yes, plus zeta 1 times z2 plus z3. And that's it.
And you want me to zip all the zetas to all the z's?
I want to zip just the zeta 2 and zeta 3.
Just the zeta 2 and the zeta 3?
Yeah.
So let me rewrite it first of all. This is, by the way, the first time ever that I'm doing such an exercise myself.
So if you think it's not feasible...
No. Of course it's feasible. I mean, I should be able to do it. At least I should be able to type it into the computer and get the answer. The program will work.
Okay. Sure.
So you said zeta 2 and zeta 3 are the variables.
Yeah.
So let's separate. So z... Oh! This is just linear.
Yeah.
Okay. So here, So let me write it as as zeta 4. Okay, let me write it as exponential of zeta 4. Z4 zeta 2 plus zeta 3 sorry, plus z4 zeta 3 plus z2 zeta 1 plus zeta 1 z3. Sorry, I've done nothing. But I've only highlighted that this is y2. This is y3. This is eta 2, and this is eta 3. And the quadratic form, the constant term is 0, and the quadratic form is 0. Well, if the quadratic form is 0, then q tilde, being the inverse of 1 minus 0, is 1. So q tilde is the matrix 1, 1, 0, 0. Okay? So, my formula gives the determinant of q tilde. So this is equal to the determinant of q tilde, which is 1, times the p goes away. So I just get the zipping of no p. And then multiplied by e to the c, c zero, so no e, no terms. Eta I, so basically the quadratic form that you get by speaking the identity between the two etas, so zeta one, zeta one. So zeta one, zeta one, and the two zk plus yk. So z2 plus y3, sorry, plus y2, and z3 plus y3, right? Mm-hmm. And this quadratic, this is just the inner product of this with this. So it's zeta1 z2 plus y2 plus zeta1, oh, sorry, again plus zeta1, so plus z3 plus y3, so overall I get just this, so e to the zeta1
y2 and y3 are both z4.
Zeta, sorry, z2 plus y2 plus z3 plus y3, okay? Sorry, and I now still have to zip. But there is nothing to zip. The, I mean, since you didn't give me a p, there was nothing left to zip. So basically I can use the whiteboard for the first time, and the answer is simply e to the zeta 1 times that thing, okay? First time ever I do such a computation by hand.
Computer yes. Disagrees.
You mistyped.
Can you type it in
there? Can I type it? Well, we're out of time. Should we?
Get rid of the break.
What?
No, let's do it in the break.
I'll do it during the break. Okay, the computer can't disagree. Okay. Okay.
I was thinking that Z2 and Z3 would disappear in the result because I'm contracting over 2 and 3. Zeta 2 and Zeta 3 disappear?
Oh! I forgot! Sorry, in the formula. I forgot! In the formula. The formula. Sorry. The Z has no differentiation, but it still has evaluation. So you're right. So Z disappeared. You're right. So it's only Zeta 1, Y2 plus Y3.
So it's twice Z4.
What?
Yeah. You got
sorry.
It.
Two times by four.
Yeah, yeah. So you are right. I
so the answer is twice.
Okay. Two Z four
Zeta
one. Zeta
one. That's the answer. That's the computer
what?
Yeah, yeah. Leave you both of it. Yeah, it's
five two and five three. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, what? Oh, yeah, right. And I forgot what they were. Yeah. So okay. So we agree.
This is why we do it on the computer, right?
It was in the past I had faced such a computer, and I had
okay.